Good morning, diners and travelers and revelers and
all of the above, right?
Tipplers and whatever, and all of the above. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we want to wish you a wonderful 2016, a health, happiness, prosperity, and, well, today's program will tell you
today,
need a lot of gin.
This program is going to be extraordinarily instructive, interesting, fascinating even, possibly, a whole program on the subject of British gin. I feel a little bit like I'm talking to the three witches in Macbeth.
Why?
This morning. Because
what, who do you want? This is Mark Dawkins speaking from Langley Gin. What do you want us to say first, Peter?
Mark, you spoke up first. I thought that perhaps our listeners are not really all that familiar, at least here in the United States, where gin was born in bathtubs, as to the history of gin, which actually goes back rather a long time. Perhaps you can give us one version, and then we have two other people on the call. We'll ask them for their version of how this spirit came to be invented.
Well, there are I'll keep it very potted, because if you think about the three distilleries, Sam is based in London, our distillery is based in the Midlands, and Quintessential's main distillery is based up in the north. So we're all about 100 miles on from each other. There's various versions and myths and truths around the history and where gin came from. And there's lots of websites and references. But generally, most of the brands who know what they're doing have got most things relatively accurate on there. But, you know, it dates right the way back to William of Orange and all the way back there. And there's some great history. And obviously, probably the most well-known history is of that in London, which I'll leave Sam to cover, given that he was the first gin distillery to be built in London for 200 years. But, you know, there's lots of history around gin. It's probably the most English of spirit products that's known. It's been around a long time. It's had a real renaissance probably in the last 7 or 8 years, but that was probably started at least 10 or 15 years ago. And it continues to, it would appear to show no sign of abating. It continues to go from strength to strength. What do I put that down to? I think that gin offers a lot more drinkability and versatility and breadth of flavor profiles than, for example, vodka, which was probably the trend that was happening in the UK before that. Dark spirits became a bit more polarizing for the next generation, I would say, and a bit more challenging. White spirits is an easier way to get into spirits as a whole. Vodka was, as I said, in the 90s, very easy to get into. It's quite a neutral flavor. Really, it picks up the flavor from whatever you mix it with. It's great for cocktails. And then we saw the emergence of premium and super premium with Absolute and Grey Goose, respectively. And I think gin has followed on from that. But in England, obviously, gin is more English. It's more well-known as a category. We take it closer to our hearts. But there's much more versatility available because every gin is different depending on the blend of botanicals and the number of botanicals.
Yeah, I never knew how different.
There's a lot more different flavor profiles.
I didn't know how many differences there could be in a drink like gin.
Now, Kate, let's pick up if we can. So Mark said that gin came over from Holland, I guess, with William of Orange, who came and married Mary, who was the daughter of Charles II. Am I right there? Did I get that right?
Yes, you did. So gin dates back all the way back to the 17th century. There's actually a nice story around the Dutch bringing gin or Geneva across over to the UK, and that's why we talk about courage being Dutch courage.
Oh, no kidding.
So the original liquid was given to soldiers in order to help them, in order to give them a bit of courage before they went into battle. So a really lovely kind of history that we continue to sort of talk about. I think from Quintessential Brands' point of view, you know, our main gin brand is called Greenalls. And it has been produced at our distillery up in Warrington since 1761. So we're really proud of the fact that this is a 250-year-old recipe, and one that we, you know, continue to distill and make to this present day.
Now, let's recap just a little bit there on a couple of things to clarify to our listeners around the world. We're talking about gin as an English spirit, I guess, as opposed to a British spirit, where you get into some kind of contest between gin and whiskey. And of course, the tradition in the British Navy was that you fired up the crew of your vessel in the British Navy by giving them a tot of rum every single day. And a tot was quite a good-sized measure, wasn't it?
I would imagine so, yes.
By rum.
I don't know why was rum. The army had gin, so I guess the navy had to have something else.
I see.
And I think it's only very recently that they actually stopped dishing out a ration of rum to every sailor in the U.S. I mean in the Royal Navy. But Sam Galsworthy, hello Sam, welcome. Now, what's your version of how it all started?
Well, I think everyone's touching it. I think, you know, there are so many different stories, and I've never seen more books on the history of gin coming out in this era as I have now, and I've read many of them, and they all tell slightly different stories, but they're all fabulous. And that is why I think gin is so exciting, because the growth of anything that really is exploding at the moment is all around storytelling, and I don't think anything has got a more exciting and more compelling twists and turns and stories than gin. You know, when King William of Orange came over, and then the English eventually then fell out of love with the Dutch, the Londoners fell so much for the spirit Geneva, but loathed the Dutch, and decided to bury the word Geneva and call it gin instead. They shortened the word, made it gin, and it then became cheaper than beer. I mean, Londoners who essentially brought up on this world of beer were actually turning their back on this drink and really going for gin, particularly because they'd renamed it, and this was now in the 1700s. And, you know, so bad was it that one in four habitable structures in the city of London had its own distilling equipment. I mean, it was a sort of a modern-day crystal meth and demet taking place. I mean, everyone was distilling gin. It was a horror show. But then a series of gin acts came into the place. In the late 1700s, six gin acts took place in sort of 4 years. And the first and the last, I think, were the most relevant one was known as the sort of the Disaggregation Act, which meant that if you were a gin distiller, you couldn't actually make the alcohol from which gin is made. And it's a law that is still in place in London anyway, which is why the majority of all global distillers around the world who craft gin actually acquire a neutral spirit for it. It's what we call a canvas upon which we paint. And the other one that came in, the other act, was the £50 Act, which meant that if you wanted a license to distill, it cost you £50, which in today's currency is around about £75,000, so knocking on the door of $100,000. So, you know, you got a sense that actually it was only the wealthy that were going to be able to get involved in gin. But whether that was the case or not, what ended up happening was an incredible families ended up developing these gin brands. Greenhills obviously being one of them, and a very famous brand at that. You've got the Borough families, the Tanquerays, the Gordons, and I think, you know, these giants are the shoulders on which we stand today. You know, these brands. And Sipsmith went back, you know, when we started the distillery in 2009. We wanted to make gin the way that gin used to be made and the way gin should be made. You know, we went back to the old school methodologies. We anchored ourselves in classicism, and I think that is what we have always strived, you know, to be is sort of such a respectful hat tipping to those masterful distillers that went before us, but introduced it, I think, in a more sort of relevant, fresher era. But there's no doubt about it that gin is just an amazing horizon now of wonder, of intrigue and curiosity and quality. It's very, very exciting.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Now, it's intriguing. I seem to recall that, in fact, since the original botanical that was used was juniper, I thought that the similarity in the sound of juniper and the name Jenever, which was the name given to the gin produced in Holland, which Prince William of Orange brought over with him, am I right there?
That's correct. Jenever is the French word for juniper. They say that one of the first ever recordings of juniper and alcohol being distilled together was in the foothills of the Alps. So they say in a very small little town called Geneva, where there was a botanist that existed there called Paracelsus Sylvius, who was harvesting these botanicals. And one of his favorite elixirs was the distilling of a grape spirit with juniper. His records show how it helped the digestive system and any sort of stomach ailments. It was very, very good for the system. And they've proven, actually, that, you know, the compounds, the esters in the juniper berry, the Juniperus communis, actually does have some beneficial properties to the digestive system. That's not to suggest that alcohol does either. I should suggest.
Don't tell that to her.
I understand that is one of the stories.
Hello.
You know, the word Jenever that the Dutch then used was, in fact, the French word for juniper. So gin, we believe, certainly at Sipsmith, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, probably the first time it's ever recorded is in Geneva.
Now tell me this.
Hold on just a second. Anne wants to input something here. Go ahead, Lou.
I wanted to know if all gins must have juniper.
Definitely.
Well, yeah. In order to be classified as a gin, you have to have the main botanical, the dominant botanical, as juniper. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you end up with, you know, lots of gin sort of tasting the same, as it were. And one of the things that we do at Quintessential is, you know, we've developed more recently gins that fit different flavor profiles. So one of the gins that I manage is called Bloom Gin. It's a light and floral gin, and it was actually the gin that Joanne Moore first created. And this is a very light and floral gin, so we have lowered the juniper level. However, on the more herbaceous gin, such as Berkeley Square, that's where you'll really feel the juniper notes prevalent in that liquid.
Now we picked up a funny story the other day. It seems appropriate to include it in this discussion as well, because over here in the United States we had an evil thing called Prohibition, which most people, other than the Women's Temperance League, didn't really understand. But we discovered the root of bathtub gin.
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting. And it's not as incendiary as you would think. I mean, the whole name bathtub gin, it sounds like it was indeed made in a bathtub, which wouldn't necessarily be very sanitary, I suppose, you might say. But it turns out we discovered that the reason it was called that was during Prohibition, people were indeed making their own gin, and they made it in these huge glass containers called carboys, which are generally associated with moving acid around, but I guess they got diverted into the making of gin. And it turns out that one of the parts of the process of making gin is you actually control and, if necessary, reduce the alcohol content by adding water. And it turned out these vessels were so big, they couldn't put them in the kitchen sink. The only place they could think of that where they would be able to add water to the spirit was to actually put it in the bathtub.
And that's that story.
So that's what bathtub came from. And the guy who actually wrote a book all about Prohibition and drinking during Prohibition. One particular point, he notes in his book so that someone was asked what how long you should age your gin. And his response was, it would be a good idea to wait until it came to room temperature. Yeah, I thought you'd think that was funny, too.
Well, we know you have to have juniper in gin. What is the distinguishing characteristic? I thought I used to think I knew, but now that I've had all these samples of all these different gins, I don't know anymore. What is the distinguishing characteristic for British gin?
Well, I think, shall I jump in there? I mean, I'm happy to. I'm not sure there's any singular, distinction, when it comes to the rational flavours. Quite rightly, every recipe is different. Every piece of equipment that people use to craft the gin on is different. So you aggregate all the different ingredients, both the canvas, the different botanical matter, and the processes used, and you will get a completely different flavour yield. People will, make their liquid more distinctive emotionally as well. So people will stand and represent for different things more than just a straight flavor profile. I would hope, Anne, that of the gins that you've tasted, you can taste that there is difference, amongst them.
One
thing we are seeing is that in the world of gin at the moment, there's an explosion of sort of hyper different styles of people using exotic and extravagant botanicals. And I think that's these days is called a bit of a Western style. So, in America, this new wave Western style, people are going to be moving a lot further away from what traditionalists might refer to as being a flavor profile of gin. London, also British gin, has probably got a little bit more, a refinement and classicism to it. It doesn't make it better or worse. It just means that, the flavors are probably going to be a bit more balanced, but you won't get quite the same hit and, that you'll get from others. And I think a lot of it depends on what you're looking for. I don't know what you guys think, but, I probably said some things that are, I don't know.
Well, I think you're probably right, Sam. This is Mark here from Langley's. And that's what I said right at the outset. That's the beauty of gin. There are some gins that have got a single amount of botanicals in them, and there are some that have got over 40. And when there's so many different botanicals that you can use, and some of the newer age gins have introduced stuff that's not been used in gin before, albeit the base flavors come from some more classic botanicals, then you're going to get a load of different styles and a load of different flavor profiles, whether they're drunk straight or in cocktails or mixed with tonics. And you're starting to see that. There's been a real surge in new styles of gin that probably all started with a base that is more classically known as a distilled London Dry. And they've come through. Obviously, probably the most well-known one in the market right now is Hendrick's with the cucumber flavouring profile to it. But, yeah, there's lots of different flavour profiles, but I guess if you are going to nose and taste gin, when people say that's got a classic gin nose or a classic gin flavour profile, then it's probably the likes of juniper and citrus that are coming through more prominently.
Now, how does the botanical flavour get in there? Who would like to talk to us a little bit about the actual process of making gin in the first place? I mean, I know with vodka, what you do is...
We can all probably talk about it, Peter. There's different styles and different processes and methods of making gin and making spirit and making alcohol. We do a classic single distillation in a copper pot still, where we actually put the botanicals into what's called the charge, which is the mix of our grain spirit, alcohol and water. And we heat our pot still, or the liquid up in the pot still, to a certain temperature. And then we leave obviously most botanicals have oils in them, like citrus peel and juniper berries and coriander seeds and what have you. And when you heat those up in liquid, the oils get released and start to flavor that liquid. And we leave it overnight, which is called macerating or steeping, to add more flavor. But there's lots of different ways of producing gin. Some people put it in a basket above the liquid, in a different type of still, and what have you. Ours, as I say, is a very classic process. using an old English copper pot still and a single distillation with primarily classic gin botanicals, a bit similar to what Sam was saying earlier, where we're trying to strip it back and pay homage, if you like, to the way gin used to be made, albeit we're rounding it off a bit more at the edges these days with the techniques that people have learned over time.
Now, what you're doing, when you're done with what you just said, the overnight macerating, you then heat it all up so that the alcohol vaporizes, the flavored alcohol vaporizes, and then you collect it.
Again, there's different ways you can draw the liquid off and do different cuts where you've got the heads and tails and the heart cut, which is the best part of the distillation process. So, But in general, that sort of classic method that we use is relatively, when you think about how perhaps other spirits are made and take how much time they take to make, is a relatively short process. But there's a process where it's left overnight to flavour, and then we crank it up again in the morning.
Now, Kate, your process is very similar to that, or?
Yes, I mean, as Mark just said, there are different processes that we apply for different liquids. But it's essentially a single distillation. We hand fill the botanicals that we use, which vary by different gins. We heat them in a pot still and redistill. It is, quite a quick process. On average, it's about 24 hours. Yeah, it depends really on from which gin that we're talking about within our portfolio.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
A question here. I'm assuming I'm right. There are not that many female-owned gin distillers in England.
Your company, the Blumen Ophir, who unfortunately can't join us because of a family issue, but is a lady distiller. Now there are not that many lady distillers out there. Is what she was asking. Yeah. Is that true or not?
Yes, but that's very true. So Joanne Moore is the first female gin master distiller in the world. She's been working at Quintessential Brands, at J&J Distillery, for 25 years now.
Wow.
She graduated from university with a chemistry degree, but she's also very creative. So we talk a lot about her when we're marketing Bloom Gin, which is available in the US. You know, really, Bloom is about women for women. So it's a really lovely story that we're able to bring in Joanne Moore as the sort of forefront, the kind of pioneer of Bloom Gin.
Yeah, please tell her.
Also, Gleaming, the next one. We've got a fantastic. We've got three distillers here at Sipsmith, and one of them is a phenomenal talent, I think, and is going to really make her name in long term in gin as well. Her name is Kit, and she's phenomenal. And I think this is one of the differences. Actually, you know, we've got three distillers. I mean, you look at people talk about scale. You know, we've got three distillers that make what we make, and I think you find that, you know, this is actually a huge amount of distill hands crafting such a little amount of gin. I think that's the difference between us and perhaps some of the really, really big guys, is that, you know, we I'm sure, like you guys at Greenhills, there's more than one distiller, but, you know, I went to one of the really big ones quite recently, and there's literally one distiller and lots of little buttons. And so when people talk about handcrafted, you know, I think this is all to do with the numbers of hands that are truly involved in the process. And I just do not believe that we would have the quality that we have here without the number of hands that we have crafting the gins that we have. You know, I mean, ideally we won't employ lots of people, but, you know, we've taken the decision that having hands crafting is a central thing. We have three pot stills, we actually now have four, and we have three distillers. You know, and what Sipsmith makes in 1 year, the company I was went to go and visit, makes between 9 and 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, so half a day. Mm-hmm. And they have one distiller. We have three distillers making what they make between 9 and 2 in the afternoon. It's quite a remarkable reference
it
to
is.
Scale and really what handcrafted means. There's a big debate at the moment about what is craft. And I said, well, come down and we'll show you.
Now, the interesting thing is I was going to invite you next, but do this only within the limits, of course, of secrecy. But what are some of the major differences in the botanicals, which are the things that I guess make the gin, between Sipsmith's Blue Morphia and Langley's Number 8? And if you say I'd prefer not to answer that question, I will understand.
Well, it's Mark here from Langley's. I don't know, actually, if any of us state which botanicals in total are in our gin on our products. I don't think we do. I certainly don't. I know there are brands out there that have their botanicals in full list.
I do,
packaging.
So I can say afterwards. But, yeah, carry on.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we use, when we were developing Langley's Number 8, I really wasn't that precious about whether we used 4 botanicals or 40. What I wanted to do was achieve that classic flavour that we were striving to achieve, and we went through a, for want of a better expression, a trial and error process of making lots of different blends and mixes of botanicals with a clear base of botanicals in mind to achieve that flavour profile. And we kept sort of, we made a ridiculous amount of different batches and flavour profiles and number of botanicals we used until we got to the final recipe. But I think when we've done blind tastings with people that are well known in the industry and are regarded as aficionados, then most of them can pick out the majority of the botanicals that are used in our gin. But as it says on our back label, Peter, I wouldn't want to divulge them all.
No, I understand. Now, why is it number 8, by the way? Just before I forget, I really...
We went through a fairly lengthy process to get the balance of alcohol and flavour profile right. And we got it down to a final sort of 12 recipes that we'd gone through that thought might make the cut. And there was a different sort of range of alcohol levels in each of those. And we did a blind tasting with some of our people at the distillery and some of our team. And the 8th one of the 12 was the one that we all felt had the right balance in terms of when you've tried it straight in tonics, in a number of tonics as well, because you can't be reliant on the tonic to deliver your just purely the tonic to deliver a good gin and tonic. And it was the 8th one of the 12. So we didn't really know what to call it either. So we weren't very creative. We said, well, we've made it and we make it at Langley and it's the 8th one. How about we call it Langley's Number 8?
Tell me this. Are craft cocktails actually cocktails as popular in the UK as they are in the States?
Craft cocktails.
Yeah, let's come back to that one because I do want to talk about cocktails and concoctions generally. I thought we might ask Kate. You mentioned Bloom, and why it has the name it has. What about Ophir? Ophir looks Oriental.
it's
exactly.
Indian.
It is.
I mean, it's a glamorous bottle. It's a glamorous bottle with a scarf, with a muffler
much.
Around the
glamorous
neck.
Story. Ophir is about the ancient spice route. And we found this wonderful story, which is all around this legendary region called Ophir. That's why the name features on the bottle. So this is a legendary region around the time of King Solomon, where everyone used to trade spices. Gold and exotic materials. And because of this story, you find the elephants on the label. It's gold, it's red. And we've also brought in the elements of the spice root into the botanicals that we use in the gin. So we handpick the botanicals from along the spice root. You've got Telturi black pepper, you've got cardamom, so really rich kind of flavour profile. And together they work really well. We've actually just won the gold, double gold in the San Francisco Spirits Award.
Oh, great. We actually talked to the guy who organises that contest a few months ago. Yeah, we talked to him. He's a master or something or other. He's a master taster. And we said, what do you do in your spare time? And he said, well, I'm actually sort of the convener of the San Francisco Spirits Festival, which apparently is gaining quite a reputation as the place to showcase your product. Now, Sam gets an interesting prize at Sipsmiths, because I've seen miniature bottles, but I've never seen a 375 milliliter bottle before. Packaging.
Oh, a half size bottle. Did we say that we sent you? Did we shortchange it, Peter, with a half size bottle?
I just thought it was so precious. Maybe that's the main reason you could only spare half a bottle.
Well, I think it's.
But is that actually available?
Lucky you.
Is it actually available for retail in that size? I mean, it's a very interesting size.
In the United Kingdom it is, yeah. But we're available in America in the 750 ml. But it's much more useful to send over the smaller size bottles, where you get through so many samples, and much better that it gets to the smaller size bottle. You'll still get the impact, of it, and. We're all about sipping at Sipsmith. This isn't about, volume, Peter. This is about quality.
Of course, I understand. Now, what's this? You have a fascinating story on sort of little index cards with very small print. But can you sort of go through some of that in detail for our listeners? Just what is it that makes Sipsmith so special?
Well, when I lived in America for 10 years and we got experience in the world of craft, both in beer and chocolatiering and bakery, and I just couldn't help but be enamored by, how consumers felt about, people investing in their own point of production and, people being able to answer the questions of how things were made, where things were made, by whom they were made. Just the full sense of it, just back to the United Kingdom. And with my best friend and my business partner, who was at Diageo at the time, we decided to go back and sort of reintroduce gin the way it used to be made, and should be made, we think, which is just on your own pot still, the people can come, see it, touch it, feel it, learn the story. And we were very fortunate enough to have met an incredible man called Jared Byrne, who's a master distiller and drinks historian. And he said, I'll only join you if we set about making it a very classic way. And that meant both from the one-shot methodology, as well as the type of botanicals and the processes that we use, that was absolutely key. And so that was a journey that began 7 years ago. And we secured the first license for 200 years, in London, the home of gin. And I think that has been a really important emotional anchor in our journey that we can always sort of come back to. And we've enjoyed something like 40,000 people through our distillery doors since we started. A huge number of people. It just goes to show how much people care about, where things are made, how things are made, and being able to see, the emotional facets of a business as well as just, a bottle on a shelf. It's just very exciting. And, we started 6-7 years ago, and it's been just an epic journey. And to see and also know how many amazing gins there are in the race too, it's superb and a very exciting part. So, we've got a fun story to tell as well, which is great.
That's what it is. Now, I wanted to move on next to the area that Anne was headed in. A few moments ago.
Can I just add something?
Sure, of course you can.
You brought up this little thing that looks like, those little color things.
Swatch
things. But they're the ingredients, and they're very particular. And I just wanted to just mention how particular the ingredients that they sourced, Sipsmith, were. Like, it's not just juniper berries. It's Macedonian juniper berries. And it's not just any orange peel. It's Sevilla, Seville orange peel. And the I don't even know what this orris root is, but it's Italian. And it's the root of the orris flower. It binds and harmonizes. So this is a little blueprint of how you approach a gin.
It is. I mean, we reference every single one of the ingredients that we use. For us, it's always been part of the educational process that, you know, people should, you know, see, learn, touch, smell, experience, share. And I think, I wouldn't have known myself personally where on earth to start around the world looking for, you know, cinnamon bark, that Jared went to Madagascar. Same with some of the other ingredients. You know, we actually know the farmer on Macedonia that brings us the berries. And I think part of what craft is all about is being able to answer the questions of, you know, where do you source your ingredients? And these days people are inquiring far more about sustainability of things. And, you know, and I think if you could answer all these questions, it's just a lovely part of the journey and the story. So we're very revealing, we're very sharing, and, you know, very inclusive. And I think that's a really important part of what Sipsmith is all about.
You made one big error.
Oops, look out.
You are using Spanish licorice root. The Queen would not like that.
Oh, dear.
You know about the Queen's passion for
licorice.
For licorice, and you know where she gets it.
Did you actually know that? Apparently, Queen Elizabeth II has a standing order for licorice root coming from Calabria. not just Calabria, but the town of Tropea, Tropea, which according to well, at least according to the Queen, I guess, is the world's best licorice.
Yes, and erred that one.
Well, I can correct that. That's the beauty of having a small business. You can turn on a dime.
Now, I thought we'd go on next to the movement towards mixing gin with something else, and if we go back to when I was drinking gin for the first time, which was more than half a century ago, there were really only two ways you drank your gin. You drank it with tonic, or you drank it in what was called either a gin and it or a gin and French, depending on whether you were adding dry or sweet vermouth. Now, is that still going on, or have we moved on in sophistication?
It's Mark here from Langley's, Peter.
Go ahead, Mark.
There's, I think, mixology, for want of a better word, bartending skills. We went through, my age group, we went through the 90s, which was pretty ghastly for cocktails, to be honest. Everything was neon blue.
That was sweet.
The 80s and 90s, terrible things were happening. And a bit like with gin, there's been this sort of, this revisiting of the classics with cocktails as well. And as Sam and Kate will know, if you go into good venues now, which again are increasing, and even some of the venues which perhaps didn't serve cocktails before are getting into them now in a more basic sort of way. But the classic cocktails are really coming to the fore on cocktail menus now. And it's good to see, because good cocktails, classic cocktails, are made with good quality ingredients and the right techniques. But yeah, gin and tonic is still by far and away the most prominent way that the drink is drunk. I'd probably say globally, 90+% of gin is drunk in gin and tonics, and certainly in the UK and Spain and places like that. But there's a growing number of classic cocktails that are working their way back onto the menu now that are using gin as the base spirit. The martini, the martinez, a dirty martini, a dry martini, a naked martini, a gimlet, you know, a Gibson. But there's also some real creativity in bartenders. I saw that in America when I was out there in October, you know, in Chicago and New York. There's some really good stuff going on with bartenders who are creating some new stuff using gin as the base spirit for cocktails. So I think there's a much broader repertoire now of drinks to get your lips round for gin, but without a doubt it's still primarily gin and tonic and martini are the prominent drivers in consumption.
We just had a presentation by some bartenders at a new bar where we live, and they had an ice program where they had one where there was a Japanese technology that vibrated ice cubes into shape.
Then, wow.
And then there was the one with the big chunk that they added the water from the tap water to the bottom, and all the impurities rose up to the top, and then they could chop off enough so that you could sip your drink and not have it diluted. We had one that had curry in it, and I'm still not sure about what the basis was.
You mean the cocktail?
I think the on-trade environment is such a creative channel for spirits brands, and I'm working quite a lot at the moment to develop specific serves. They're outside of gin and tonic, and although, you know, Mark just said it's about 90% of gin that's drunk with a tonic. With Bloom, we're also talking about a French 75, which is delicious, with Prosecco, Bloom, and a bit of lemon juice. But we also serve Othea, because it is a heavy, spiced flavour, with ginger ale. So there's lots and lots of things that the gin and ginger, or a Gigi as we call it internally, probably won't catch on that. But some really interesting things going on in Spain as well. You know, I've witnessed bartenders with using tonic, so as ice cubes, so freezing ice cubes made of tonic with, in Bloom's case, you know, dried flowers inside them. I mean, really, really creative. And things that people can easily do at home as well.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Now, it's interesting. The first conversation I think we had about an ice program was with, was it Sam or Eddie Hart? I can't remember which one. They own several restaurants, including
yeah, they're in Fino, don't they?
Yes, yeah. That's Fino and
we were actually at Quo Vadis.
Quo Vadis, who's Jeremy is our buddy there.
Jeremy Lee is the chef, but Eddie was telling us about their ice program and how they had different shapes and, different.
They're serious about this cocktail business.
Yeah, but the bar here, what's it called? The rye bar. What are you talking about? And they make
Butcher and the Rye.
Yeah, they make their ice in 300-pound cubes, and then saw it up into chunks. And then in other cases, in other cocktails, they shave the ice so that it will cool the drink faster if they want that to happen.
Well, anyhow, we're getting a little off the subject here.
The future of gin is secure in the hands of these lovely ladies and gentlemen that we've been talking to today. But do you see anything changing? I mean, you're part of a wave of change anyway. But is there change yet more to come in the future, do you think?
Other than that, there's still more gin to come. There's still more consumers to convert. And there's a lot more energy from the producers that you're listening to today, you know, to offer the market. I think there's a lot more creativity that's yet to, you know, to come out. We've all talked about classicism. But also there is a sense of creativity. I mean, I know that at Sipsmith we have this thing that we call this sort of restless enthusiasm for, you know, pioneering new flavors. And so while we anchor ourselves in classicism, we're always attempting and crafting new experimental stuff. And I think that won't ever stop in this industry, regardless of the trajectory that gin in of itself takes. There are new world gins coming out, in other words, markets creating gin that no one 6-7 years ago might have even imagined being made to them. The barriers of entry are much lower today than they've ever been, making it a more competitive arena, but therefore much more fun. I mean, brilliant for the consumer who wins who really wins when it comes to gin, I think, and quite right too. I think lots more positivity and energy, and it's all good.
Now, Kate, your organization is somehow part of a much larger wine and spirits company. Am I correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Does that change your viewpoint at all, or are you existing as an artisan spirit maker, just happening to be owned by somebody else?
So our distillery, G&J Distillery, is based up in Warrington, and it's been there since 1761.
Wow.
So when I mentioned Joanne Moore earlier, she is the first female gin master distiller, but she is only part of seven master distillers who have retained the recipe for green ale since 250 years. But we've recently been bought sort of 4 years ago, so we're now a privately owned company. We've been bought by an investment banker and a gentleman called Enzo Bizzoni from Campari. You're very true to say that we're now moving into different categories. However, my heart is in gin. So if anything, I just need to fight a little harder with the commercial guys for that time. But gin is the heart of our business. You know, it's very much at the forefront of everything that we do. And I think, as Sam just said, there is so much creativity in gin. When you compare it to any of the other categories, in my opinion, vodka being one of them, there's just a lot more to go at. It's very exciting. And the global market for gin is dominated in three markets, the US, Spain, and the UK. And there's just so many more opportunities over that. It's all very, very exciting.
Now, why Spain? That's really rather intriguing.
So Spain is actually where the sort of gin renaissance started.
So
Spain is mainly an on-trade market. So really the trend started with consumers in bars. It's everything to do with garnishes for specific gins to specific glassware. All of the Spain, or the majority of the gin drunk in Spain is drunk out of a balloon glass, so a sort of very large, kind of like an oversized red wine glass. So there's lots of things to look at over in Spain.
Now, it's funny, we were at a restaurant in Barcelona at lunchtime. And we observed a gentleman having lunch on his own, but he had an unusual mixture that they brought to him. They brought him Coca-Cola and a whole bottle of gin. and he simply helped himself. So if he wanted a little more gin, he poured a little more gin in, and then he added some more Coca-Cola. I thought the idea of mixing
Coke and gin.
I think it was either Tanqueray or Gordon's, and I thought the people at Tanqueray or Gordon's must have been turning over in their grave, having a gin and Coke.
But no, you're right. But I think that's one thing that over in the US, certainly not the sort of top mixology bars, but something in the UK as well, we're trying to bring back from Spain, is this real obsession about theatre and the on-trade environment. So when you order a gin and tonic in Spain, you're brought out a tray with, the chosen brand that you've decided for that evening, and, tonic that may be ice cubes of tonic, along with different premium tonics,
which are also
important.
We've sampled Fever Tree, and then this, what's the other one called Q,
Q from America.
They're two different. I think Fever Tree is made in the UK also, is it not?
Yeah, it is. Fever Tree. When you talk about Renaissance of gin, and there are probably several brands that can. There's two certainly that probably quite rightly lay claim to starting the change in just all about Gordon's and Beefeater 15, 20 years ago. But you talk about tonic, and Fever Tree are the real catalyst for the change in perception of tonics and the premiumization a tonic water as a mixer and a category. Fentimans has been around for a long, long time. Schweppes obviously have, and Schweppes dominated the market, but I think Fevertree coming along, when they did, probably about 9 or 10 years ago now, was the real seed of change in the tonic water market. And since then, there have been numerous premium tonic water launches. And gin's not that different, really, albeit there seems to have been about 300 new gins launched in the last 10 years as opposed to 20 or 30 new tonic water. But there is renaissance and premiumization in tonic to go with your gin, Peter.
Now, what's going to happen at Langley's? Is there going to be a Langley's number 16, or?
I can guarantee you there's not going to be a Langley's number 16.
No.
I can also guarantee you that there is going to be more products coming from the Langley stable soon, but I can't say any more yet.
Ah.
Okay. Well, let's
a hint. Can we have a hint?
No, he can't do that. His competitors are on the phone. you guys must have had fun. We actually found these three ladies and gentlemen, by the way, thanks to the UK Department of Trade and Industry, which had a special tasting in New York City that they invited us to, where there were 22 British gins on display.
Yeah.
And you're saying that there might be as many as 300. But as we wrap up, be aware that On the Menu Radio is heard all the way around the world. So we've been talking about gins that are available principally in the UK, also in the US. Talk to us, each of you, if you would, about where your products are available in the whole global space. And also your website, so that people can connect with you, and even if they can't get you in their country yet, they'll be able to start encouraging movement in that direction. So who'd like to go first? Kate, ladies first.
Thank you very much. So our main brand, Greenalls, you can get more information on greenalls.com. It is available in the US, and we've got distribution, sort of higher concentrated distribution in New York, Chicago, California, and Minnesota. That's big news for Greenalls. And then my other two brands, Bloom Gin, created by the world's first female master distiller, is available in California, New York, and you can find out more information on bloomgin.com. And finally, O'Pear is also available in Minnesota, California, New York, Boston. And you can find out more information with an interactive map of the journey that O'Pear takes in order to be made on opeargin.com.
So, but what about if you're in Russia? Where do you get it?
Yeah. We haven't launched in Russia yet.
Okay.
So if you get it out of your suitcase,
in other countries outside of the US, they're available in the UK, obviously. O'Pear is actually the fastest growing super premium gin brand in the world. They're available in Spain, Portugal, and we've actually got some good distribution now in Australia.
Oh, good. Good.
And who's up next, Mark or Sam? Go for it. Which one?
Go for it. Okay. Langley's number 8's been, we launched Langley's number 8 about 2.5 years ago. We launched in the States last year. We're in about 20 states now in the US. We're more prominent than in others, in some than others. And I'd say our prominent states are, or our prominent cities and states are Chicago, Illinois, New York, Florida. Particularly Miami and Naples, where we've done some work recently. And we've also had some real success in Dallas and Houston in Texas, and over on the West Coast in California, in LA, predominantly. We are working with a really good import partner in the States, which just helped us get into those states. In other markets, we are just launching in two provinces in Canada, in the early part of next year, we launch in Mexico, and we are also available in about 10 or 12 markets in Europe, Spain, Poland, Italy, Denmark, Germany, and a bit like some of Kate's brands, we're launching in some further afield markets next year. The website address is langleysgin.com, and if we aren't in your market yet, if you're listening in a market where we're not, then I can't believe that Amazon won't get it to you if you try.
Go ahead, Sam.
We're in 30 or something states in America. We've been there for 2 years, so look out for us over there. We're in about 33 countries globally, you know, from Asia, you know, down just north, a little bit of Africa and all around Europe. So, you know, you'll find us in all those specialist stores and bars. Look out for us at sipsmith.com and at sipsmith and at sipsmithgin. But thank you very much for listening.
Thank you so much, all three of you, for joining us today. It's been a very interesting and intensive view of the world of gin. We're so glad that once again England leads in something. And I'm guessing that maybe those tennis players take a few sips on the side.
We're trying to get them to, Peter. We're trying to get as many champion sportsmen from England as we are gin brands.
Great. Well, yeah, once again, have a great day.
Okay.
Where you are, the sun is definitely over the yardarm. It's time to have a G&T or a martini
yes,
or whatever.
Absolutely.
I like this, the thing, the France. Or what is it?
We can't do that for another 4 or 5 hours. But it's amazing that we made this work with all the time zones to take into account. So, once again, we wish all of you the very best of luck. We wish you prosperity. And
happy holidays.
What do we say?
Happy holidays.
Who knew there was so much to know about gin? Can you believe it?
Yeah.
So listeners, you now have the opportunity to call yourself true experts on gin, having heard from three really outstanding producers of really top quality artisanal gin and a lot of the story of gin as a whole. Right, sweetheart?
Yes, indeed.
So we know what you're going to drink as a cocktail in the new year, I guess. And 90% of the time, if you're drinking gin, it's going to be gin and tonic. And that's all we have for this week. Again, a happy new year. We hope that you will have as wonderful a 2016 as we plan to have. And in the meantime, until we talk to you again next week.
Bye-bye.